was going to say, non-Anglo-Saxon community. And again, that it sounds very racist these days. In those days, it was nothing. It was just those new Canadians or something like this up there.
Ukrainian up there, is a Jew?
A lot of Ukrainian. That's Jewish North End, but I don't recall the Jewish people being anti-military. But certainly mid-European people up there were very anti-military. And this, of course, is where the communist stronghold is in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. still is.
Joe
Zupin and mm-hmm. Penner and Bill Ross and all these fellows, their stronghold is all North Winnipeg.
I'm thinking now, I've never heard this of the boys getting thumped out. Would there be still resentment from the union strife, in combination with the communists? I'm thinking of the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919, the militia was sent in.
No, I don't think that was it. I think it was just the general anti-military propagated in large measure in Winnipeg by the communist element.
With depression and...
That's right. Why are we spending money on this? And there's such things going on now. You still see fellows here in Victoria saying, hell with buying jets for the Air Force, put that money into welfare work. The same, but it was much more accentuated then. And this business of military getting thumped is not peculiar to Canada. I recall going down to Washington when I was heading up intelligence, it'd be about 1969, I guess it was, and I was staying at DuPont Plaza Hotel. And one stay, I did 4 years in Washington, 49-53, and our embassy and our headquarters quite close to DuPont Circle.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I used to wander up and down Connecticut Avenue at night, no trouble at all, window shop and things like that. And I was told not to leave the hotel and walk DuPont Circle unless there were about three or four or five or six of us in a group went out. And I just hardly believe this, and I was over in the Pentagon talking to a laddie, a senior officer over there, the next day, and said, "What's this nonsense about not?" He said, "You better believe it." He said, "One of our lads walked through there in uniform, and he was given a tremendous beating." And he said, he came from Meade, one of the Fort Meade, which is just in Maryland, north of Washington, D.C. The next day, a platoon or two came down, and they tidied up that DuPont Circle and laid them end to end, and the police came along and said, "Thank you very much. You fellows better get back to Meade," and that was the end of it. So what's peculiar to North Winnipeg? Anybody in uniform, I suppose Washington a little bit different, maybe. It was against authority in Washington, whereas against in Winnipeg, it was against authority in Washington, whereas against in Winnipeg,
Which your ideological, which is even more scary, I guess, in that sense. Was there any concern then by your fellows?
No, not really. We didn't. North Winnipeg, really, and as a matter of fact, I used to walk. I suppose about. Certainly two, maybe closer to 3 miles to the armory Wednesday evenings to parade and back again at night. No trouble at all in uniform.
What about other military relations with the community? I know the pipe band was well received and you had your PR was well done through the pipe band and your parades and things, but I'm just thinking of just the local people other than the North End. They just couldn't care less about you, or...
Well, the other people, I think, probably tolerated us, wondered what the hell we're in it for, and we're crazy, warmongering, things like that. They must remember the game. Canada, before World War II, was very anti-military, very anti-war, very anti-everything, much
well,
as
would
today.
Have, you would have, the, during this period, Bennett was in government then. R.B. Bennett, the Conservatives.
32, 34.
He was up until
35. 35, yeah, okay, 35.
Now, I know Mackenzie King was no friend of the military, let's put it that way. But R.B. Bennett, though he couldn't spend the money, there was sort of government support, or did were you too junior to see that?
King, I can't recall it.
I'm asking not esoteric, I realize.
Well, our CO for... the guess, at least 3 years before the war broke out, and certainly when we mobilized, was an alderman in Winnipeg. So he was able to win elections and still be in the military, so he wasn't that bad.
What I was getting at, though, I guess, is what did you, in the mess, was there any talk about government and their spending? Was there a lot of griping?
No, no, not at all. Not that I recall. No, no, not to the same extent there is today. People didn't gripe in those days the way they gripe now. People didn't, you say maybe our social conscience or whatever it is was not awakened or things like that. We accepted the facts of life. The facts of life was that the country was hard up, period. And everybody was being pinched, so why the hell should we gripe? Where was it going to come from? It could only come out of those of us who were working, the extra money, and I suppose we accepted the fact that we're no worse off than a hell of a lot of other people, and therefore, what's the point in griping? Like to see it better? Sure. Like to see better equipment. We had no equipment, basically, and things, and sure, I suppose there was some talk getting into 38 and certainly early 39 about the lack of military preparedness. Then you'd hear talking about.
You became more senior than, of course, before.
Well, senior to the extent I was no longer second lieutenant, I'm now a lieutenant. You see? Yeah. So I'm now senior.
Yeah, but of course, you had to know someone died in those promotion.
And promotion didn't mean anything anyway. You were in it.
You were getting paid anyway.
Sure. Well, pay didn't matter. You were in it because you wanted to be there. But I suppose around the mess in those days, and one must remember when you say around the mess, it's not like a regular force, you know, where you're around the mess every day. We're not around the mess every day. You're meeting once a week or maybe twice a week, and you're doing things other than sitting around drinking beer and shooting the breech. You're there for a purpose. You're out in the rifle range, or you're on parade, or you're doing something or other.
Yeah, specific tasks to occupy.
That's right, and when you're not doing that,
you're keeping busy so they won't be complaining.
That's right, and if you're not there, then you're at home, or you're out with your girlfriend or your wife or mm-hmm. whatever it is, you see. So it's not the same as if it was a 24-hour job assignment.
Speaking of militia again now, I'm thinking of training. You talked about there would be a parade, if you can recall, I know it's a long time ago, what would you do when everyone gets dressed?
Well, okay. The first parade, of course, was you fall in by company so you could check off the roles and things. That was the basic thing. And then it all depended what stage of training you were at. Younger officers in particular, would take the... when they weren't undergoing training themselves, would take the recruits and probably do some parade bashing, right turn, left turn, arms mm-hmm. drill, things like this. So they it was training for the younger officers in terms of command, of developing authority and things like that.
And smartening up the others.
And putting the others through their paces and mm-hmm. training them. And so it was, the recruit was being trained, but so also was the officer, the NCO, who was particularly, it was always under the guidance of a good NCO, a well-trained NCO, but the young officer was there being trained as well.
How were you treated by the NCOs?
Oh, fine. It was just, in my recollection, just a happy association, and there was no...
I'm just thinking, though, because it's such a... The regiment, is the way you've described it to me, is not an old boy network, but... Everyone was there for the same reason, okay, mm-hmm. like it is today, I understand, but everyone was there, but I'm just thinking of the distinction between officers and other ranks. Was it held high, or was it a very amiable relationship?
There was a very amiable relationship, but it wasn't a buddy-buddy relationship in terms of hi Joe, hi Bill, this sort of stuff. When you're on parade, well, let's put it this way, as a second lieutenant, my major company commander was Sir on parade. Outside, he was Andy or something like that. And the same thing with the NCOs. The NCO could be Tommy outside, but inside he's Sergeant Major this, and you're Sir to him, period. And that was strictly maintained, I must say, and there was otherwise, it just the system would never work.
Okay, fair enough. With the training itself, though, like you said, you start off and you put the boys through the paces. What other types of
There's the small arms.
Drill?
No, yeah, it was small arms. What do they call the range? Small bore range downstairs, the small bore range, in the basement of the armory. So there's firing down there with 303, or the Enfield converted to 22. It was like a 303, only 22. Then there was the training. Lewis gun, the old Lewis gun. You know, they put it together, assembling it, all that sort of jazz had to go through. I forget what that was called, but you had to strip it. Stripping and assembling, I guess it was called. I go through that.
Do you have an old Vickers laying around?
We weren't Vickers. We weren't machine gun. Didn't have machine guns.
Oh, I just thought might be one laying around.
No,
to play
we had Vickers in those days. Vickers. We had Lewis. Then, of course, there was all the tactics, sand table, and a lot of the officer time was spent in sand table exercise, sand table.
Were these exercises developed by, say, the British Army?
No.
Experiences, say, from your senior officers?
Senior officer, too, who had set it up, or I suppose fair to say that the Patricias provided us. There's an instructional cadre at Fort Osborne made up of permanent force officers and warrant officers, NCOs, who were on there. And the instructional cadre was a separate thing. They weren't regimental. In other words, they're taking all strength of the Patricias, say, and put on the instructional cadre. And we used to get a sergeant major and a sergeant each parade night. And as I recall, an officer occasionally, and the officer would run some sand table exercises and things. He would design them, he'd set them up. And they're very simple. In fact, they could be map exercise rather than sand table. And the maps probably are the Shiloh area, something like that, perhaps gearing us up to go for our summer camp, things like that. I don't think of any other training. I can't recall first aid I don't think was taught until war broke out.
What I'm getting at was there a program, a definite program?
Definite program laid on by the military district and implemented by the regiment, by the CO, I suppose, to IC responsibility, and certainly the company commander's responsible. Each company had their own training program, and you knew tonight what you were going to do next training night. In other words, you had a week to get ready for it if you were going to do any instruction and like that. You had a week to do.
Now, what company were you with? Do you recall?
Company was I? A company, B company. B company, I guess it was.
So you'd be in infantry. You weren't in like...
Oh, no, I wasn't we didn't have support companies those days, I don't think. But I was not in the signals. I don't think we had mortars in those days. I'm sure we didn't.
Now, as your particular rank as a second lieutenant, now your company... commander would be a
major.
Then his
2IC would be a captain.
That'd
be three platoon commanders, lieutenants or second lieutenants.
Now, would you be a platoon commander? Mm-hmm. Or would you
be a platoon commander?
You were a platoon commander.
I would have had a sergeant and three corporals and I don't know how many men. I can't recall now how the companies were straight.
Did you feel great power?
No, not really. It felt as though you were just
in the work.
No, just many times I felt that the NCO knows a hell of a lot more than you do. You better hurry up and catch up, so at some stage you'll know more than he does, so you can really run this show. You see that you feel competent to run it.
There's no doubt in your mind when you first took over the NCO was running.
Oh, no doubt about it. That he had much more knowledge and experience than I had, and although I was giving the orders, it was because he—I won't say approved of them beforehand. But if I didn't give the right order, I knew that he was going to tell me so. And that was part of the training, and one of the values, I think, particularly as so many of our NCOs had World War I experience at that time. These fellows have been through the hoops, and they were accustomed to dealing with men. Where
they weren't going to be snowed by some second lieutenant.
No, but also a lot of them were, again, you must realize that these weren't professionals. These were fellows who had civilian jobs, and some quite responsible jobs, although they themselves were NCOs. You know, they were foremen of works,
mm-hmm.
and things like this. That what they wanted to do was to make certain that they trained us, the junior officers, to a standard that they would find acceptable if they were the guys that we were going to command, you see? And they took it quite seriously.
I'm just comparing. I'm thinking, in the Navy, an officer, before he became that officer, he'd become a
midshipman
there and be known as Snotty. And
no.
Okay, Snotty, way you go. But everyone from the top guy to the bottom guy on the ship would be helping him to train him, and I guess I'm thinking as a second lieutenant, I guess everyone in the regiment would be trying, you know, working on your training of command, learning how to command and working, trying to help you. I mean, I'm not thinking overtly, but subconsciously everyone knows.
In my experience, and what I know of the naval midshipmen, a second lieutenant is a commissioned officer, a midshipman
mm-hmm.
is not. And in my experience, I was never treated, as I understand midshipmen were treated, in terms of, degrading, I would almost call it. Bullying tactics or fagging,
mm-hmm.
this sort of thing.
I'm not suggesting that it's an equivalent or anything, because as a second lieutenant, I mean, you were commissioned.
No.
Whereas these are just a step above cadet. I mean, there is quite a difference there, but what I'm getting at is, as a second lieutenant, am I correct in assuming that from the top one in the regiment, from the colonel on down, everyone was trying to help you along as best as possible, to train you, to help you with things, and just because you had the pip on your shoulder did not mean that you knew everything.
Oh, exactly. Oh, quite true. And certainly in most regiments, certainly in the Camerons, the regimental sergeant major is empowered to see that the junior officers are well trained.
Now, would he be the one who would put you through your paces, is that correct?
In some cases, the regimental sergeant, particularly if a very important ceremonial is coming up, he'll get the young officers out and train them in drill, sword drill, things
mm-hmm.
like this. Very definitely. Oh, yeah. The RSM.
Now, would you call him sir?
No. You call him mister.
Mister.
Yeah.
And meant it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Back to the training. I know we're just about done for today, but back to the training itself, what about equipment? Now, we mentioned you would have to outfit yourself, but would the men have the first war kit?
Web equipment. Pouches, as I recall, for ammunition, pack, rifle, the old long bayonet.
It'll be in number four, cold steel.
Yeah.
Thing was long too. My God.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back whether we respirator. I know that I. I took a month off and went out to Sarcy and did an A-wing. One summer, which is a small arms
mm-hmm.
wing. I'm trying to think now whether we were issued with respirators or not, gas masks. I know that I went through the gas chambers, you know, these things on, did some training. I know I did that out at SRC. And whether that leads me to believe we had it in the regiment or not,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether we had it or not, whether we had respirators issued. I hardly think so. But
when
certainly I don't.
When you hit camp, okay, your major camp would be Shiloh.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what was it like? Was it were there any permanent buildings around then, or was it still pretty much an under canvas operation?
I first went to Shiloh when Shiloh was opened up for training as such, and I think there were three permanent buildings. All the rest was canvas. It wasn't primitive. You were under canvas, period. And this was part of military life again. And as a family, we used to go camping, you know, tents and things like this. So I didn't find any great hardship. In fact, it was much better because there were showers. And granted, the first one in got the warm showers, and that was the water that was in the pipe, and the sun had warmed it up. Mm-hmm. So we all were busy. We get in the shower first. From then on, it was just water from the tank above. But I didn't consider it primitive. In fact, I suppose part of the fun of being in the Army in those days was this type of experience of living under canvas, and great big marquee, which is your mess, and great big marquee, which is your dining room, and things like this. The latrines, and might say they're primitive, but you're living outside, you're not sitting on a log or something, to me it was just great fun. I enjoyed it quite a
bit. What kind of exercises would you go on, do you recall?
Well, platoon exercises, company exercises, and I think we ended up I remember one year doing a night exercise. Everybody got lost, but that again was part of the training.
What type of things would you be doing, though? Like would you have war games?
Oh, yeah, company in our platoon in the attack, platoon in the defense, and company in attack, company in defense. I can't recall ever doing any withdrawal exercises at that stage. Nobody withdrew, you were told, so nobody practiced or held tight. That was the old theory, I guess, from World War I or something. But
maybe digging trenches.
Yeah, that's taking up defense.
Trenches at this time, or was it the old?
I'm not sure that we did much digging. I can't recall doing much digging. It was more a question of marking out on the ground because the area was used continuously. I don't think that it would have stood up. I'm sure it wouldn't have stood up to indiscriminate digging all over the place. And I think it was merely a question of outlining, saying this is my defense. This is a section here, and a section we get down on the ground. Two men here, two men there sort of stuff, and say, okay, he is in a slip trench. You must remember, too, that we were, at that stage, pretty adept at imagining things, simulating things.
Tank on the side of a car, right?
That's right, and say, okay, now that is where the Lewis gun is, or that is where this is, and that is where this is, when in fact it's not there, but that's where it is, sort of stuff. And you've got to have enough imagination to visualize it sitting there, you know.
One guy's jumping up as a company.
That's right, and you may have a platoon of 15 men, and you're supposed to have a platoon of 30, 35, so you say, well, that's three men there, we see one, sort of stuff, you see.
How did you view yourself at this time, very seriously, or...?
I think we all took it quite seriously. It wasn't just a great big lark or anything. Sure, we realized the constraints that were on us and the fact that we were really... Well, nobody was kidding themselves and thinking we could go to war tomorrow sort of stuff. Nobody thought that we were battle-worthy or anything else like that, but neither was the permanent force. We recognized the fact that we were almost as good as the permanent force at that stage. We liked to think that we were better, and we used to continually say, of course, we're much better than the Patricias. We can do this better than the Patricias, but that's part of the old malarkey. That's part of the old Army game. Every unit's the best going, and if they didn't think they were the best going, they shouldn't be a unit, period. In hindsight, you can say, of course, we weren't as good as the Patricias, but we all thought we were, and, you know, this is one of the things that keeps you charged up. But even the Patricias were not fit for war in those days.
Nothing to brag about.
No.
I'm thinking, would you consider yourself, you wouldn't consider yourself amateurs, or would you? Enthusiastic amateurs, maybe.
Well, we must have considered ourselves as amateurs. What else were we? We were training once a week in the wintertime, not more than twice a week in wintertime, and the 7-day camp doesn't make you a professional.
Were you known then as Saturday Night Soldiers? Was that the common term?
No, in those days, that was a post-war phrase, I believe. I never heard that phrase beforehand. A lot of people used to say, of course, playing soldiers. This is, I suppose, been in for generations. I don't know. But certainly, yes, you were accused of playing soldiers and all this sort of stuff, but that didn't faze us at all. No, I don't think we were under any illusions as to our capabilities. We felt that we were doing as much as we could. We felt that what we were gaining in knowledge, was at least a step in the right direction and would shorten the time that it would take to get us ready for war or for any military endeavor. And I think that was a fair assumption, as events proved, I think.
Well, sir, I think we've got a pretty good start today, and time is marching on. If I can come and see you again, I thought we could pick up with the change.
I have some coffee. Would you like a cup of coffee before you go?
Well, I'll check it over here in a flash. All I'm going to say is thank you very much for making the time.